You're listening to Strong Runner Chick Radio, where our goal is to educate, empower, and connect female distance runners. If you enjoy this episode, be sure to leave a review on iTunes or any platform of your choosing, or share it with someone who might find this episode helpful. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the show. Special shout out to today's sponsor and the sponsor of this entire Health as a Foundation to Sports series, Athlete Blood Test. They provide individualized, athlete-specific blood analysis to discover your unique nutrition, training, and recovery needs. Join the thousands of enthusiasts, elites, and pros that have already used Athlete Blood Test to help reach their goals. Testing is easy. Simply go to athletebloodtest.com, choose your panel, and schedule an appointment at a conveniently located lab core. Whether you're running your first marathon or competing to win, we're cheering for you, and we can help you get there. Use code SRC15 for 15% off your first panel. Hello, Strong Runner Chicks. Welcome back to another episode of SRC Radio. It's Megan here today, and I am joined by Dr. Anna Roby, who I'm really excited to chat with today. She's got a number of credentials. So as you noted in her introduction, most likely, she is actually the only PhD and registered dietitian in the world with all Ivy League degrees specializing in sports performance nutrition. That is incredible. And she's also the chief research officer of Athlete Blood Tests. So she works with a variety of athletes to really help them optimize their biomarkers and fuel their bodies and achieve their goals. Really excited to have you on the show. Oh, wow. I did not know that fact about you until reading your bio here. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've heard you on another podcast or two, and I know you talked a little bit about kind of your background, how you got interested in this field of study. We do have a lot of, you know, college students and, you know, maybe people that are thinking about a career change on here, as well as just passionate runners in the field of sports nutrition. So how did you go down this path and really get your start in athletics and then leading into your career?
Yeah, so it was definitely kind of a circuitous journey. I started off in college thinking that I wanted to be pre-med because I've always been fascinated with the human body. And so that seemed like a great route to go down. But as I got into some internships and kind of did some shadowing, I noticed that there were a lot of doctors who didn't have great work-life balance. And there was a lot of burnout and it seemed really intense. And so I shifted away from surgery and decided to go down the nutrition route. And, you know, because I always thought it was so fascinating how what we eat can affect our body and how we feel and how we can perform. Because I've been an athlete pretty much my whole life since I was 3. So I really thought, well, that's a cool idea. Let's maybe blend those two. And so freshman year of college, I had to write a 10-page paper about my dream job. And so I chose sports nutrition and realized that, oh, I have to be a registered dietitian to do that, like technically. So, so I went into dietetics and I did a double major in exercise physiology and nutritional sciences. So I really like to nerd out on the kind of the science behind nutrition and exercise and how those two work together to kind of help with performance and health. So I did my undergraduate degree at Cornell University out in New York, and I absolutely loved it. And then I applied for their combined PhD and registered dietitians program. They take one person every year to do the two together. And so I was lucky enough to get that. So I studied there for quite a while doing research, as well as doing clinical dietetics as part of my internship. And then after grad school, I moved out to Washington, D.C., where I was doing research at the NIH, looking at a variety of different diets and kind of how that works in a more of a clinical setting. So after I had kind of finished up this research, I really wanted to kind of get back to the sports nutrition side of things. So I started in private practice and also started working with Athlete Blood Test, where I am now. So it's been a really fun journey to kind of go through down rabbit holes. So for anyone listening that isn't quite sure what they want to do, I would say it's okay. You don't have to know exactly what you want to do. And, you know, listen to that curiosity and go down those little rabbit holes that sound interesting to you.
Yeah, I love the way you put it there, just kind of like following. That was going to be one of my questions, is like, how do you stay focused? You know, I
for instance, started off in dietetics and was sort of like, oh no, I don't want to do feeding tubes and renal, but I know this is the route, right, that ultimately... Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Getting
We're good.
Feedback on the mic. But yeah, just relating to kind of your story of like wanting to work with athletes in some way. And I think a lot of people maybe can relate in this way of like, I know I'm interested in this field, but I don't know where to get started, or like keeping the bigger picture in mind of where you ended up. And I think it's so cool that you're one of the few or the only PhD and RD in the world with those Ivy League degrees in sports performance. So, you know, just really, yeah, value your expertise. And I'm like, glad you went into this field. I wanted to jump back to your own journey, your own athletic journey. Did you sort of have any personal experience that led you to pursue this path?
Definitely. So as I mentioned, I started in sports when I was 3, I began in gymnastics. And so I really enjoyed that and always just being active as a kid, you know, playing at the park and running around. And so gymnastics was a good fit for that. And then I did that until I actually joined the track team in 6th grade. I started running track. And that was just so fun. You know, I thought, what's better than, you know, running with your friends after school, you know, and going to the track meets. And I just loved kind of that whole atmosphere with that. So I ran track for several years, both individually, but then also as part of a relay, which was really fun to integrate kind of that team aspect into an individual sport. And then I kind of dabbled in some other sports just to kind of take advantage of the opportunity to do so. Cause I thought, well, I can run my whole life, but I can't play lacrosse, you know, as an adult as easily. So I, you know, played varsity lacrosse for a few years. And then in college, I kind of had the same thought pattern, like, hey, let's take advantage. And so Cornell has an equestrian team, which is horseback riding. So like jumping and that sort of thing. So I actually did that in college, which was really fun. And then post-grad, kind of when I was in Washington, D.C., I got back into kind of more running and started doing some races. And so I've, you know, post-grad, I've been more kind of just doing the racing and running and, you know, some strength in there too, but just staying active more so.
Yeah, definitely. I love, you know, just the ability to relate to athletes. I think sometimes comes from that to having the background, even if it's not in running specifically, but that is a really cool mindset too. I have some friends that are adults and play in like different leagues, but it is a little harder to be part of a team sport. I think running is something you can, it's sort of accessible. You can do pretty much anywhere. So yeah, it's pretty nice in that regard. I wanted to also ask, like, once you started working with athletes one-on-one or in group settings, what were some common things you noticed, whether that was misperceptions about how certain, you know, things were? I don't want to go too in detail, but I want to let you answer, you know, like, did you start to notice any sort of patterns, whether it was among runners, specifically female athletes, or, you know, something that our listeners might be able to learn from?
Yeah, definitely. So I started to see patterns after working with athletes for a while in my private practice, specifically with female runners. We kind of have this mindset that thinner is better and thinner is faster. So, you know, everyone under the sun seems to be trying to lose weight, thinking that's going to help them with their athletic performance. But what I've really worked with athletes to do is kind of shift their thinking and to kind of get to the root of those thoughts and kind of get rid of the weeds, if you will, and kind of replace those with more helpful and kind of healthy thoughts instead, so that they can really shift their perspective to see food as a tool that can help me do what I want to do. You know, you'd never show up to the start line of a race without your running shoes or sports bra. And, you know, it's food is the same thing, right? It's a tool that's going to help you perform your best. So trying to kind of shift that perspective from food is something I should fear, let me limit this, eat as little as possible, to, hey, this is something that I need, this is going to help me, and to really kind of get a different, fresh perspective on that. And so that's something that I've been really passionate about, is, you know, taking that psychology part of it. Because I would notice, like in my early years of practice, I would give athletes their recommendations and they would go, great, this is exactly what I need. But then they would be like, wait, do I really have to eat this much? Like, you know, so they kind of had one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake, and they end up just spinning their wheels because they're like, okay, I know I need to eat this, but then they've got these underlying thoughts of, this is too much food. I'm going to gain weight. This is going to make me fat, whatever it is. And so now I've kind of started to work with athletes to, hey, let's talk about what are those limiting beliefs that are kind of holding you back. And once we get rid of those, oh my gosh, to see what people can achieve is so incredible. It's like, you know, they're hitting new PRs that they never thought they could once they get that proper fuel in place. So that's something that I've really noticed is kind of shifting that mindset from more of a restriction and less is better to fueling like, hey, I need this. This is a tool that I can use. So that's probably the biggest, I would say, you know, misconception. Another thing that is somewhat similar is just kind of following some of the fad diets or thinking that, oh, well, you know, my roommate is doing this, so I should do it too. You know, oh, my mom is intermittent fasting, so maybe I should do this. And, you know, what I tell my athletes is the kind of general recommendations for food and nutrition, they don't apply to us as athletes. Yeah. So we have our own set of recommendations and rules, or suggestions, I should say. And so it's really kind of shifting away from kind of blocking out that cultural noise and kind of focusing on, hey, what's going to be best for me as a female athlete?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as someone that's been in like the competitive female athlete space for a while, I sometimes, there's just some interesting things about like the rest of the world that maybe got into it later in life where, you know, I have friends that are just getting into the sport and like, oh, should I go for that fasted run? And I'm like, what? No, like, I don't know. I'm not an advocate myself of like, you need to go for fasted runs. So things like that, where you're kind of your ears perk up, or I had a friend that was like, yeah, I got out of running because it was for the same reason, but she thought that she was like alone in that and nobody else had that problem. And I was like, oh girl, like out in the collegiate sports world, that is everyone pretty much, which I don't want to state that for everyone, but I feel like most female athletes have, you know someone or have struggled with that, like how much do I fuel and how do I do this in a way that's beneficial for my performance and not get caught up in that trap. So yeah, I just think there's still so much to be learned and like shared, and that even if you're someone listening that is not a competitive athlete, you know, you still have that sort of like responsibility to yourself, hopefully, to take care of your body and like fuel yourself in a way that, you know, supports performance and isn't just like focused on your body. So yeah, I don't know if you see that across the board too, like working with non-competitive or maybe like more people that consider themselves more recreational runners too.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing is, your body doesn't know the difference between a competitive athlete and someone who's just training recreationally or for fun. You know, all it knows is, hey, this is the demand you're placing on me, and this is what you're giving me to work with. So if those are kind of imbalanced, then, you know, your body doesn't really know the difference. So,
yeah, I'm almost wondering if you can speak to that, like, you know, in some way, a professional athlete or someone that's been running for years is probably more well adapted to running than maybe someone who's just getting into the sport. And like you said, someone who's just getting into running or just starting to run more hills or trails, like they might need a lot more fuel because their body isn't, you know, adapted to the demands they're placing.
Absolutely. And I've worked with everything from kind of people who are recreationally active to, you know, professionals and Olympians. And so I've seen everything in between. And when you have that really kind of top end athlete, they usually have a whole team supporting them. They have a sports psychologist, they have a registered dietitian, they have, you know, massage therapist, right? So they have this whole team that's kind of helping them. But you have anyone who's, you know, amateur and recreational, and, you know, we don't all have our own staff to support our running endeavors. So, you know, it's really, I would say, even more important for people who aren't at that top level to kind of pay attention to their nutrition and their body, because they don't have kind of all of these safety nets from a staff that's going to support that. And when you start training, or, you know, you're getting back into running or running for the first time, your body is definitely adapting. And nutrition is really what allows your training to work. It's kind of the key that's going to unlock your, you know, training success, because if you're not properly fueled, you're not going to be getting those training adaptations that are intended from your workouts. Whether you are, you know, working with a coach or just following a plan that you found online or whatever, those workouts have specific, you know, intention behind them. So, you know, they are trying to give you some sort of specific adaptation, whether that's endurance or maybe you're doing lactic acid, you know, threshold training or whatever it might be. And so that all takes energy for your body to adapt and to adjust and to get stronger and fitter, essentially. And so if you don't have that energy to be supporting that, your body's not going to be getting those training adaptations. So you end up seeing slow to minimal progress during, you know, your training season versus an athlete who's well-fueled can see pretty significant progress in their, you know, their training and their results.
Yeah, absolutely. I also wanted to ask, I know it's hard to make any blanket statements because everyone's nutrition is individual, but are there any, you know, we talked about like misconceptions people have around fueling, but any general guidance around like, you know, athletes should be eating at least 3 full meals a day and maybe a few snacks, or like eating around their workouts, or anything that you in particular would just guide an athlete towards like thinking about, like making sure that they're getting enough of everything and kind of, just like basic principles that you're checking off with athletes.
Yeah, definitely. So I think a bare minimum would be like 4 meals or eating occasions per day. You know, you definitely want to make sure you're eating before and after workouts. And I have a lot of athletes who work out first thing in the morning and they say, well, I'm not hungry. You know, I don't want to eat breakfast before I work out. And so that's fine. You definitely don't have to have a full meal, but have a few sips of some sort of carbohydrate or carbohydrate and protein that's going to help get you out of that fasted state, that's going to help with that workout. So, you know, it could be a few sips of juice. It could be, you know, or a smoothie, a few bites of applesauce or, you know, yogurt, you know, anything that's going to be liquid or kind of semi-solid like the yogurt or applesauce, just to kind of quickly get that energy into your cells and to kind of help switch that kind of track from that depleted, more fasted state into the fueled, the fed, the ready to go state. And we now know from a lot of research that, you know, fasted workouts are actually harmful for women. And so I don't recommend any fasted workouts for athletes. And again, you don't have to have a full meal, even if it's just a few sips of something. That can really make a big difference in terms of how you feel, how you perform, and even your hunger later on in the day as well. Mm-hmm. So eating, you know, some carbs beforehand, carbs and protein right after your workout within 45 minutes. Men have a much longer post-workout window than women do. We have, you know, much closer to that 45 minute mark. So if you can get something in within 45 minutes, that's fantastic. And then, you know, having your meals throughout that. So, you know, we're looking at 4 to 6, you know, meals/snacks per day. I don't recommend going more than 3 to 5 hours at most between eating. So you definitely want to kind of make sure you're having some food periodically throughout the day, because we know from research that even if you're eating enough total calories throughout the day, if you're going longer stretches of time without eating, you know, so 5 or more hours, that actually can be stressful enough on your brain to kind of alter that hormone function and sort of start to shut down some of our reproductive function. So definitely want to make sure you're kind of spreading your energy throughout the day instead of kind of just clustering it.
Yeah, absolutely. You spoke a little bit there too to the whole fasting thing, coming back to that like intermittent fasting or fasted runs. And it sounds like whatever benefits, and I'm taking it, people say it's like fat burning or training their body to burn fat versus carbs. That's what I hear, at least. But I'm curious, like, what is your take on it? And just in terms of, like you had said, the hormonal consequences, or why someone might, if someone's listening that has been down that path of fasting, why might they consider not doing that?
Right. So I did some intermittent fasting studies as part of my dissertation. So I get really excited when I talk about intermittent fasting, because it's a hot topic right now. And so I think it's really important that we kind of talk about the science when it pertains to female athletes, because a lot of the studies have been done on, you know, on men, you know, obese subjects. So it's not particularly relevant to, you know, a female runner who isn't in that situation. So when it comes to fasted workouts, you know, you do hear this, oh, wait, you know, sometimes it helps with longevity, or, you know, it has all these benefits. Well, if you look at the list of purported benefits, and I say purported because we don't have a ton of strong human trials to support this, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say we have these benefits. they're actually the same benefits that you get from exercise. So you don't get to double up. So any of these supposed benefits you're already getting from the exercise. So it's really not giving you any additional benefit with that. So the next point then, as you mentioned, you know, you burn more fat. This is somewhat true, but here's the thing, is you're burning fat that's stored in your muscle. So this is called intramuscular triglycerides or IMTG. So you're burning this IMTG that's already stored in your muscle. It's not the fat that we think of when we think of body fat, right? We think of the fat that's stored under our skin, between our muscle and our skin, right? So wherever that may be for people that it seems to bother them, that's not what you're burning. You're actually burning the stored stuff in your muscles. And that's just going to get replaced the next time you eat. So it's really not this additional fat burning benefit that some people once thought. And they've done a lot of studies too, that you don't actually burn more fat if you look at like the totality of the day versus, you know, fed and fasted. So when you're fueled, you can actually push a little bit harder and probably get a better workout than when you're kind of running on fumes if you're fasted. And again, not being able to get kind of some of those same training adaptations. So from a hormone perspective, when we are running fasted, this disrupts something called GnRH pulsatility, or gonadotropin-releasing hormone. And what this does is this sends out like little pulses to our hypothalamus, which is a part of the brain. And this says, hey, I need you to produce hormones for me, LH, FSH, and this in turn is going to produce progesterone and estrogen. And so when we run fasted, this essentially changes the beat of, or the pulsatility of this GnRH. And so the beat kind of starts to get messed up. So it's like, you know, the DJ's messing with the beat. It doesn't sound quite right. And so this is how our hormones can kind of get askew when we start to do fasted workouts. So I strongly encourage athletes to take that fueled path, knowing that it will be better for performance, for health, and even sometimes body composition. There's, you know, no benefit now we know from doing the fasted workouts. So
thank you for clarifying. I think that's really
my pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. Team anti-fasted, I think, for women athletes, especially. But in terms of, let's see, top biomarkers, I want to jump a little bit over to kind of biomarkers and also like touch on red S. So we could start with either one that you feel is relevant, but like, since we're on the subject more so, I guess, along the lines of nutrition, you know, what do you see as some contributing factors, like you had just mentioned there, potentially signs and symptoms of red S? And for someone that doesn't know like what this is, relative energy deficiency in sport, also formerly known as the female athlete triad, but I think they've expanded the definition for males and, you know, other, right? Because you don't have to just have the triad. It could just be a matter of something else. So do you want to speak a little to red S first?
Yeah. So red S is, I think, a really important topic, especially for females, just because statistically speaking, we're more likely to have red S than male athletes. Although I'm glad they did change the terminology, because I've definitely worked with males who have gone through reds and have struggled with that. But red S can be a really tricky thing. It can be kind of a slippery slope, because, you know, there can be kind of this fine line between, you know, sort of having an edge on your nutrition and then having that kind of slip into, you know, disordered eating or being overly restrictive or overly obsessed about, you know, your food and, you know, your exercise and being overly regimented. So there are a few things that you can kind of use to look out for, to say like, hey, could this be something that I'm potentially dealing with here? There are a lot of physical signs and symptoms. So if you feel like overly tired all the time, that could be a sign that you're, you know, you're under fueling, your body's too stressed from either lack of fuel or over exercise. And usually it's a combination of both. If you notice like your hair, skin, and nails changing, your hair is starting to thin or even fall out. If you feel cold a lot, that can be another sign that your body is turning down your internal thermostat to try to save energy. So if you notice that, hey, everyone else is in, you know, a t-shirt, but I'm in a sweatshirt because I feel cold all the time, that can be a big red flag. If you feel like you're more kind of irritable and moody or kind of short-tempered than you might normally be, that can be another kind of social sign that, hey, things might be, you know, troublesome here. And also, you know, just asking yourself, honestly, like, what's my approach to my nutrition and my training? If it's something where like you're trying to fit your life around training, or is it the other way around? You know, if you miss a workout, do you have a total mental meltdown? Or, you know, if someone's like, hey, we're going to go out for lunch, does that really freak you out about like, well, I had my meal planned, I knew what I was going to eat. You know, if you're obsessively or, you know, diligently tracking macros or weighing food, things like that can be some red flags that, hey, maybe we need to kind of reassess and take a different approach to nutrition and training here. So it's way more common, I think, than people realize. Like, I struggled with it myself. I came off of birth control pills after 9 years and didn't get my cycle back for 5 months. So for 5 months, I cut out intense exercise, you know, switched to yoga and stretching, really focused on kind of resting my body, giving it more nutrition to kind of get that back. And so, you know, if anyone's listening to this and they are going through that, you know, you're not alone. There are a lot of women who have been on the podcast previously who have, you know, talked about it. I know this is something you're passionate about. So you can definitely overcome this, but it's something that you want to pay attention to and not just kind of sweep under the rug.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise, I think it's nice to just, I mean, I definitely struggled with Red S in the past and thinking about, oh my gosh, like I don't actually think much. If my friends say, hey, we're going out to eat tonight, I'm not like, where are we going? I have to look at the menu. You know, it's kind of just like, yeah, okay. You know, it doesn't need to mess with my, if it's at 8 o'clock and I normally eat dinner at 5:30, I'm not going to go crazy. Like, I think that normally used to throw me off a lot. Just about having stuff planned. And I know a lot of athletes are very regimented and, you know, to a point, sure, like having consistency is nice, but I think just being able to be a little more flexible and adaptable is a good sign. Yeah, that you have that in your life. So thank you for sharing. I also want to know just about biomarkers too, like, and also in the long, like along the lines of Red S and amenorrhea, I've heard a lot and actually experienced myself like high cholesterol or lipid panels from actually having Red S. And so, you know, for someone that wasn't necessarily eating very fatty, high cholesterol foods, it was like a big shocker to see that or to see some of those hormone levels like all out of whack. And so I wondered, like, what should female athletes be getting tested for, especially along the lines of preventing Red S or addressing Red S, and how, you know, yeah, what are you seeing among those that are experiencing it?
Yeah. So at Athlete Blood Test, we have a female specific panel called ABT She. And this is really helpful for kind of looking at your biomarkers as a whole and kind of a holistic approach to say like, hey, how is your nutrition and how is your training working for you? And it's really nice because it's an objective way to take a look at this to say like, okay, maybe we need to add a few things in because this is, you know, this is what we're seeing. Or, hey, you know, I think you're ready to bump up your training if you feel ready. So kind of giving you some reassurance and kind of checks and balances about training and nutrition and how that's working for you. So specifically looking at, you know, biomarkers, there are a few things that we can take a look at. So one of the things that we measure is LH, as I mentioned, that's really important. And it's kind of a surrogate for GnRH. So GnRH, like I said, it's released in a pulsatile fashion. So it's really difficult to capture in a blood test. So we don't really measure that outside of like research. So we use LH because it's a pretty good surrogate for that. So that's something that we look at in addition to FSH and estrogen and progesterone. So we can take a look, hey, how are your female sex hormones? Are they in balance? Is one out of whack? Are you making enough? Because if your body's under too much stress, you're going to see low levels of these hormones, and that can be a big red flag. Another thing to keep in mind is kind of red blood cell as well as iron. So ferritin, a lot of athletes who are under fueling or suffering from reds will see really low iron levels, especially ferritin. Hemoglobin and hematocrit are two other biomarkers that can be indicative of red blood cell health. And so if, you know, the body is feeling overly stressed, we tend to see really low levels of these biomarkers. And then we can also take a look in the training tolerance section to look at things like cortisol and thyroid stimulating hormone to see, hey, is your body feeling super stressed? And how's your thyroid function? Is it, you know, does it feel like it's, you know, happy in a good place, or is it feeling really stressed? So there isn't necessarily one biomarker that you can use to diagnose REDS. It's more of kind of a process of elimination, but taking a look at your biomarkers collectively can give you a pretty good idea in terms of how your body's handling your current practices.
Yeah, it sounds like that's important to look at them collectively so you can kind of connect the dots between what might be going on versus just a one-off and you're like, I don't know why I have high cortisol or low TSH or whatever it might be. So, yeah.
Right, right. And it's really helpful too if you can get kind of a series of tests because that way you can kind of compare, hey, what's my normal versus like, this is just one pinpoint. So it's really nice to be able to see kind of how your body changes. And also too, if you get a test and you're like, oh wow, my folate is really low, I'm going to eat more leafy green vegetables. And then you test, you know, 3 months later and you're like, great, it came up really nicely. It's nice to know that your efforts paid off and you can kind of like see that progress.
Yeah, absolutely. That's always helpful to hear too. I know vitamin D has come up a lot too, just with the winter months approaching. I live in Colorado now, so hopefully mine's a little better than it was in Oregon and Portland. That's rainy in the winters. But a lot of people are struggling with this, I think, even if it is sunny out. And do you have any recommendations for someone to help increase both their vitamin D and I'd probably say like iron or ferritin, just for those that have those low levels?
Yeah, so these are two really important biomarkers that I definitely recommend people see what their levels are, because then you can supplement appropriately. It can be very dangerous to just blindly supplement to say like, oh, I'm, you know, probably low in iron because a lot of runners are, I'm going to take an iron supplement. You can actually be, you know, too high in both iron and vitamin D. They can both accumulate in the body. So once you know what your level is, you can, you know, get a specific recommendation for, hey, this is how much I should supplement for how long and how to take that supplement. And these are two that we see low very often. So especially like with the ferritin, you know, if you're a distance runner, you're going to be burning through your iron stores a lot here. So it's important to stay on top of that. So I have a food first philosophy. And so trying to get as much from food as possible within, you know, reason, I think is a great approach. So looking at kind of real food and getting as much from those as you can from, you know, whether you eat meat or plant sources, you know, it's kind of up to you, but trying to get the bulk of that from foods and then obviously taking a supplement when necessary. But there's some other things you can do in addition to just, you know, food and eating red meat or and supplementation. One of the things you can do is like cook with cast iron skillet, or you can get, I forget what it's called, but there's like a little iron leaf that you can, it's like a little like medallion almost that you would just throw in your pan and cook with that. And it's going to give you a little bit of iron if you don't want to like buy
that's
iron.
New to me. I have not heard of that. Super interesting.
No, I didn't either. I wrote an article for Triathlete magazine last year and I was doing research on like how to bump up iron. And so that was one of the things that I came across. So you can just buy this little medallion so you don't have to buy all new cookware and just throw that in and that'll give you a little bit of iron to add to your food. So that's one thing you can do. Also running on softer surfaces can actually be a pretty big help for runners because what happens is when our foot hits the pavement, we get what's called foot strike hemolysis. And that can actually cause the blood cells to kind of break open and leach a little bit of iron. So we can lose more iron that way. So if you can run on, you know, a trail or, you know, grass or sand or, you know, something that's a little bit softer than like a hard concrete or pavement, that can be really helpful. And another thing you can do is pairing vitamin C with your iron intake. Mm-hmm. So this would be things like, you know, fruit or vegetables, especially tomatoes with your iron sources can actually improve the absorption of the iron. And another thing to do is to be taking your or getting your iron in within like 3 hours of your workout. So what happens is when we exercise, we release something called hepcidin, and hepcidin is a compound that actually blocks iron absorption. So it's a protein that's going to block out the intestinal absorption of the iron. So, and it peaks between 3 and 6 hours after your exercise. So if you, let's say, run at 9 a.m. and then you eat lunch at noon and you have, I don't know, chili, right? You've got the vitamin C from the tomatoes and the beans have got some iron. you're actually not going to absorb very much of that because that hepcidin is going to be increased at that point. And so you're not going to be able to get much from your food in that time. So
interesting. Wait, so to reiterate, you said try to get iron within 3 hours?
Yeah. So if you, let's say you run at 9 a.m., let's get our iron in our post-workout meal. And that way it should be digesting by the time that hepcidin starts to increase, so it doesn't have this interference.
That's super interesting. Yeah, did not know that. So I learned something new today. Thank you.
Yeah, so there are different kind of strategies you can use to kind of enhance iron. You can probably find the article I wrote. It's online. It's Triathlete Magazine. I think it's called like Beyond Red Meat, How to Enhance Your Iron or something like that. And you should be able to find the article, but some of those strategies can be helpful.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions too from athletes that are vegan or vegetarian or plant-based and just aren't eating red meat. So they're wanting to know like how they can get, it sounds like leafy greens, this iron leaf, and you know, maybe taking your supplements in that time frame.
Yeah. And if they're taking iron supplements, it's important to take the iron supplement on an empty stomach away from food, because if you take it with food, you're not going to absorb very much. So take it on an empty stomach. Some people take it like right before bed, so they don't, you know, have too much food in their stomach. But whatever works for your schedule, whenever you have a little chunk of time where you're not going to have, food in your system, then that's probably a great time to take that. Plus you could take it with a little vitamin C, like some lemon water or, you know, a little bit of orange juice or something like that. That's going to help with that absorption.
Thanks for sharing these tips. I think they're pretty helpful for those listening. So one of our biggest questions too, that I love to ask is, what advice would you give to your younger self? Like, or just to maybe a young athlete, someone that's just getting into running and, you know, yeah. What would you say to them? They don't have to be young, but maybe newer to the sport of running and in terms of maybe nutrition or fueling.
Yeah. I mean, it's very general, but I would say, take care of your body. Or take care of yourself, really, you know, your physical health, but also your mental health too. Running can be a double-edged sword for people. It's, you know, can be a great stress relief, but it can also be a point of obsession. So if you can really take care of yourself by giving your body the fuel that it needs, it will reward you. You'll feel better. You'll be able to perform better. And so kind of realizing that you and your body are on the same team and it's not you versus your body. Because I think a lot of times, especially as women, we get this sense like, oh, my body's not doing what I want it to, whether it's performance or how it appears. And so if you can kind of realize, hey, your body is doing its best for you. So if you guys are on the same team, you can help each other out, you know, your body's going to reward you in performance and health.
Absolutely. I love that advice. Thank you. And lastly, what does being a strong runner chick mean to you?
That's a great question. So I would say being a strong runner chick is, I think it means being authentic and confident in who you are. I think we are all different. And a lot of times that can scare us because, well, we don't look like other people, or we don't, you know, look like them or act like them, or, you know, we feel like, oh, well, I'm different and this is, you know, what's bad. But really, I think what makes us authentic is, you know, what makes us, you know, unique. And so to not feel like you have to change who you are, either like personality wise or how you look, to be comfortable with who you are. Because I think a strong runner chick is confident in who she is and has kind of this fierce mindset and is comfortable in her own skin.
Love that. Yeah. Especially the word fierce and confident. Gosh, those are, yeah, good qualities that I'm always trying to sort of go after and embody. When it comes to how listeners, I was just thinking about this, like, how can people work with you or connect with you? Are you, do you work with athletes in sort of a one-on-one capacity, or yeah, what's the best way to reach out?
Yeah, I do. So they can reach out. My website is dranarobi.com. I'm also on Instagram at dranarobi. If they're interested in blood testing, they can just go to athletebloodtest.com. And I know you guys have a discount code. Yep. They can get 15% off any panel. Yeah. Yeah. So, 15. Yeah. use SRC15, you can get 15% off any panel. But in terms of working with me, I work with athletes one-on-one, and I'm also launching a group program that's been kind of revamped here for 2022. And it really kind of has this sort of, I call it a triple threat. So we deal with kind of the underlying limiting beliefs in terms of what's holding us back from our nutrition. I have the logistics of fueling for athletes. So, because something that's tricky is, you know, I love kind of the intuitive eating concept, but it just doesn't quite apply for female athletes. We can't just rely on our hunger cues to guide us. If we do that, we end up under fueling because a lot of components of exercise are actually an appetite suppressant. And so if you just are, you know, oh, I'm not hungry, I don't need to eat, you're going to end up under fueling. So what I've done is I've taken kind of a gentle nutrition approach to fueling female athletes. And so, you know, giving them a food framework so they know, hey, here's the minimum fuel you need based on the number of training hours you're doing. So, you know, it's up to you in terms of how you want to achieve that. I'm not going to tell you exactly what to eat, but hey, I need to have right 2 servings of carbs for this meal. So that way they kind of have a framework and know exactly how to be fueling without feeling like they're bogged down by tracking or measuring or weighing or, mm-hmm. you know, getting caught up in calorie counts and that sort of thing. So, so if they're interested in that and want to kind of hang out with other female athletes, that new group is going to be launching next year, but otherwise one-on-one is definitely an option with me as well. So.
Love it. Thank you for sharing that. I'll, yeah, I'm excited to link that up in the show notes and encourage those to reach out to Dr. Anna, if you have any questions or want to get involved. And when does that kick off?
So that is kicking off in January.
Okay. Perfect. Great time to start. Yeah.
Yes. And then, yes.
Yeah. Awesome. Anything else that, you know, you have upcoming that you're excited about, whether it's related to your business or just life in general?
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking forward to kind of getting back into racing here. Things have been kind of, you know, touch and go in terms of racing. So I'm looking forward to getting back to running, hopefully hit some PRs here next year, but I'm also really looking forward to this group program. Because like I said, this is a accumulation of, you know, years of me combing through the research and pulling out what's relevant to women. Only about 3% of studies are done specifically on female athletes. So we want to make sure that the recommendations that are getting recommended are evidence-based and they're relevant to women. So I've spent the last couple of years going through the research and kind of leaning that and, you know, cultivating that into the recommendation. So everything is evidence-based, and then also kind of bringing in that psychology piece of it as well. Just so, like I said, I've had athletes where it's like, it's not just about the right information. You know, it's one thing to have that, but if you have this kind of limiting beliefs holding you back, it's really difficult to make true sustainable progress. So it's been really fun to kind of run. I've run a beta test here with some athletes, and it's been incredible the results that they've gotten. So I'm really excited to share that with athletes and to kind of help pursue changing the athletic culture and kind of getting into this healthier space for women.
Amazing. Yeah. Super happy that you're doing this work. And I just encourage anyone listening to reach out about, you know, just getting involved and getting your blood work done and, you know, engaging with this group if it seems like a fit. So thanks again. Yeah. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Megan.
All right. Strong Runner Chicks, have a wonderful rest of your day and hope to connect with you all soon. All right.
Thanks for listening to the Strong Runner Chicks Radio. Do us a favor and leave a review in iTunes to help spread awareness and foster the SRC community. Additionally, make sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Strong Run Chicks.